This is about the FCC monitoring station at Grand Island, Nebraska. This is based on an article I wrote that appeared in Popular Communications a while back. I really liked Popular Communications. That was a good magazine. I really enjoyed it a lot, but like most things, that if it's something I like, they take it off the market. So they consolidated it into CQ Magazine, but Popcom had some kind of a unique perspective. Since I first gave this presentation a few years ago, when I was approached to do the presentation for this event, I was contacted by Mark and Ernie, who'd also had an interest, and they included pictures in remembrances. So this presentation has been updated with some of their photos and some of the things that they recall from back at the time. And I thank them very much. Although it's no longer a human presence there, it's good to know that after a long and distinguished service, the Grand Island Monitoring Station is still alive and well. The FCC is still using it, and it's still considered government property. The picture there was an artist rendition on a postcard. People of central Nebraska were so proud they made postcards and sent them out to around the world to claim, look what we've got in our town. One of the things I want to point out, because we'll mention it later, is that tower right there, which looks like an airport beacon, and it was for aviation. I believe that this artist rendition was modeled after a photograph that was taken during the World War II era. I grew up in Kearney, Nebraska, went to high school there. It was my hometown. I still consider it my hometown. And it was literally in the shadow of the FCC monitoring station. Okay, so this is, you know, 74 through 79. You have to remember the context of the times that CB radio was a real, real big deal then. Everybody, you'd go out into a grocery store parking lot and look like an aluminum forest with all the antennas going up. So I worked at a radio shack in Kearney. Stanel Sound was the name of the company then. And we sold a lot of CBs. We probably sold more CBs than we sold stereos. But I'd get to talk to all the, our customers. You know, y'all better keep your ears low there, driver, or Uncle Charlie going to come out from G.I. Town and shut her down, 10-4. That was pretty common. And if any time a white van would drive through town with more than one antenna on it, everyone would freak out. Everyone would be on the bands. Uncle Charlie's here, shut down, you know. But I don't think I ever knew firsthand of anybody in Buffalo County who was ever jacked up by the FCC for a CB violation. I don't think they cared. I grew up, I attended Kearney State College, now known as the University of Nebraska at Kearney, and I worked at KGFW, KQKY, one of the local radio stations. And of course, back in those days, you had to hold a third-class radio telephone operator's license to be a disc jockey. In preparation for that test, they would tell us exactly what the FCC could do if you were in violation of FCC rules and regulations. And I could tell you stories about accidents or things that we didn't want to do, that we didn't do intentionally, that could have jeopardized that license, not only our own, but of the station. And of course, no license meant no job, so we took that pretty seriously. From 1980 on, my communications career led me to becoming a 911 dispatcher and ultimately a police officer, which I did for 16 years. At the time of the early 80s, I worked for the Grand Island Emergency Center, then known as GIEC. People used to ask us, can they talk to Jesse? Who's Jesse? Well, that's you saying that on the radio all the time. Well, it was GIEC is what they were hearing. In Nebraska, even to this day, most of the dispatching is done at least at a countywide basis, if not a regional basis. So our communications center handled all law enforcement, with the exception of the state patrol, all emergency medical services, all fire for the entire county. So since we were right there in the same town as the monitoring station, I thought I would drop by and see what these guys are doing. So I took an impromptu tour. I didn't even call ahead and make an appointment. I just showed up and walked in, and I'm standing in the lobby looking at the, they had a little glass display case, and guy comes walking out and about jumped out of his skin to see a civilian standing in there, what he would consider a civilian, and told him I'd like to take a tour of the place. He says, "Ah, no problem." He says, "You don't want to look in that end of the building. It's all offices and such." He says, "But come this way." And basically, he gave me a little rundown of the place. And you'll notice that it kind of looks like a not too large red brick schoolhouse building. In the airport beacon, I asked him about that. It's, you don't see it in this photo, but this is the same photo that I think that postcard was modeled after. When the monitoring station was built, it was not only was radio in its infancy, but so was aviation. And navigation was done visually. At night, there weren't a whole lot of lights on in Nebraska at the time, so they went from beacon to beacon to beacon. So if there was any government land, they put a beacon on it. In some cases, out in the deserts, out in the west, they actually put big concrete arrows. You may have read about those, where there'd just be a big concrete arrow laying on the ground that aircraft could look down and go, "Oh, Los Angeles is that way." But they already had airmail service at that time, so the airport beacon was handy. And the FAA did confirm that for me, that that's what the use of that beacon was for. And let's see. That's a 1932 picture of the inside of the control room. When I went in there, and you'll see pictures of this on the following slides, there's a large L-shaped rack with all of the various equipment and a very large bookshelf full of books and papers. Basically, they had information on every license that was current in the U.S. It was all on paper because computing wasn't what it is today. And he pulled off, he looked at my CB license and says, "Here you are, and here's your third class license. It's all on file." They could look at it by name, by license number, call sign.
By the way, you're under arrest.
Yeah. No, I was good as far as they were concerned. They also had two Model 28 teletypes. One was connected by RF, the other one was connected by landline telephone. And of course, this group was probably very familiar with back in the old days when the news would come on. You'd hear "time for news," and in the background you hear that dum 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 dum. That was the Model 28 teletype, probably that recording they were playing. We used to use them in law enforcement at the time to run all of our records checks, which means if an officer called in wanting a registration for a vehicle, it could take anywhere from 2 minutes to several hours to get a reply back, depending on how temperamental the system was that day and how fast you could type out a ticker tape. This is one of the pictures I got from Ernie, and this was taken in 1975, and it's pretty similar to what I saw when I was there a few years after. And it's kind of a dark picture. I don't know how well you can see it. We've got another one here that's even better. You can see the two Model 28 teletypes there on the far right. The two oscilloscopes, I can't remember which one, but one of them was dedicated to the RF direction finding antenna that they had. And we'll talk a little bit more on detail about that, about when I got to actually watch him chase down somebody from the
Randy,
the center.
I actually sent you those pictures.
That's right.
Those are Raycal receivers.
Okay.
John let us come and use them one Sunday afternoon.
Well, that's great. On the far left end of the console, he said, "Here's something you'll be interested in, Randy." He pointed out a standard in-dash model AM-FM stereo radio and a Radio Shack scanner that they, programmable scanner that they had mounted in there. And he said basically if the engineers were bored that day, they'd listen to music or listen to the scanner, but he says officially we're looking for ID violations. He turned both of them on. The first radio station that came up was the AM-FM station I worked at a few years earlier in Kearney, KQKY, which was the local rock station at the time. And all of our emergency center channels were programmed into the scanner. And he commented that, as far as he could tell, we've always been a good dog. We were good at identifying and everything else. I'm not going to read through this completely, but at a high level. He explained that...
Why don't you? There's some folks here who would...
Well, I can do that. All right. It was explained that in the old days, the government was monitoring not only to regulate the airways, but also to investigate possible issues of espionage, spy stuff. And that's in the context of World War One just ended, and the period between World War One and World War Two, and then especially during World War Two, the FCC was very involved in collecting radio intelligence of, for instance, Japanese ship movements in the Pacific, and they could do this with their various FCC monitoring stations. I mentioned the tower that appeared to be an airport light beacon and was asked what that was for. It turned out it was no longer in use. But back when the site was established in 1929, not only was radio in its infancy, so was aviation. Navigation at the time was by visual identification of landmarks, and in predominantly rural areas such as central Nebraska. I've got to lean over to see the screen. That's all right. Yeah. There were not a lot of lights on that might be observed from the air at night. Lights, similar to what we would recognize today as an airport beacon, were set up along the routes on any available government land, and nighttime navigation was done visually from beacon to beacon. This postcard was postmarked 1936. I'm thinking it's around 1930. And you can see there's the beacon there. That's the main station building. This was a garage. They also had a generator in there so that they could be totally... independent from the public power grid. It's interesting that about a mile west of here is what's known as the Cornhusker Army Ammunition Factory, which is a huge government reservation right in the middle of Hall County. It's about 4 by 4 or 4 by 5 miles, so it's about 20 sections of land. A lot of government presence there. The predecessor of the Federal Communications Commission, which was chartered by the Department of Commerce by the Radios Act of Acts of 1910 and 1912, and operations began to grow phenomenally after the advent of KDKA in Pittsburgh in 1921. Everybody started building radio stations then. So by 1929, the Flat Prairie region of central Nebraska, specifically an area 6 miles, it was then 6 miles west of Grand Island, was selected because of its superb reception conditions and central geographic location and freedom from nearby transmitting stations. Basically, when this was put up, there was hardly any broadcasting of any kind in that part of the country. The station was the first and primary monitoring station that would include nine such stations by the 1980s. The site was added to the National Register of Historic Places, or as I say, Hysterical Places, in 1972. This is the government's description that they used to describe the site, and this is what was used in their application to the... to make it on the historical landmarks list. It consists of 200 total acres and one parcel, and it has one large two-story unpainted building of asphalt shingled and a garage of similar construction with similar auxiliary buildings nearby. The original monitoring room contained 2,000 square feet of floor space and room for dormitories, kitchen, workshop, storage batteries. Motor generator and switchboards were provided. So this indicates that they were prepared to man the place 24/7 for an extended period of time with a group of engineers on site living there if they had to. The building was constructed from plans and specifications prepared by the Navy Department, Bureau of Yards and Docks, which is interesting because not a whole lot of Navy activity in central Nebraska.
But Nebraska has a Navy.
Yes, it does. My grandfather was a captain in the Nebraska Navy. The original site, comprised of 50 acres, was the first monitoring station exclusive use of the predecessor, namely the Federal Communications Commission, which was authorized by an act on February 23, 1927. So they actually opened for business in 1929. The nine total of 9 stations would work in concert to do triangulation on signals that they were trying to pin down. They would only need 2, but they would usually use 3 or more because it provides better evidence. There's a photo that was taken in July 2012. It looked pretty similar to back in the day when I looked at it. They didn't have they had more antennas that were actually mounted on the building. That tree by the front door, I'm guessing, is probably a mulberry tree that they didn't realize is actually a big weed. The airport beacon's gone. It's no longer there.
Is that wooden structure to the right of the building, the gallows, for those who...
offenders? Could be. The antenna farm, I asked them about that, and they said that most of the antennas were no longer in use at the time that I was there. A few of them were, but most of them were not. The one that they used mainly at this point in time, which was considered extremely state of the art, was an RF direction finding equipment that was extremely sensitive and accurate. Oops, wrong button. There we go. It may not be.
The Adcock? No.
This is what I believe is the antenna they were talking about. It would be this one right here. And this then was, like I said, hooked up to the oscilloscopes inside the building. And they would, basically a lobe spinning on the oscilloscope, and it would widen out. And
so what you're saying is that 35 years ago, those kinds of cutting-edge antennas would be still considered cutting-edge today?
Well, they're probably still in use today. They probably, I would speculate that they're probably more accurate today than they were then.
That's not an Adcock.
They had one, but...
Yeah.
Those white poles, by the way, are supporting their 6 beverage antennas, mm-hmm, spaced 60 degrees apart. Right?
Yep. And we've got pictures of that, too. There's another overall view looking the other direction. All those poles are supporting antennas. You know, before I knew more about the site, I used to think that those were literally just a bunch of telephone poles out there. Here's the beverage antenna, and I'm speculating this is looking like from the front gate looking south.
Right.
And down there on the horizon would be Highway 30. You can see the...
That was a two-wire beverage.
Yeah, that's a two-wire beverage going along the fence line there. And I'm not sure if today that road is paved or not. I would speculate it might be. The name of the road was Monitor Drive because of the monitoring station. When I first started working in that area, where I knew before I knew specifically where the station was at, is a nearby housing development called Capitol Heights, which had all of their roads and streets named after Civil War battlefields. And so I assume that Monitor was named after, you know, the ship, the Monitor. But no, it's named after the monitoring station. Okay, this is James McKinney, who was an engineer at the FCC station from 1941 until he retired. And here he describes to Mark the Adcock direction finding antenna. Go ahead and fire that up.
We've had 2 direction finders out there, Adcock-type direction finders, well away from the building, well away from everything, and nothing more near them. The first Adcock was a small house on stilts that you reached the inside of the house by going up a ladder underneath the center of the house and through a trap door, which after you got in there, you closed, became part of the floor. And in there, you had a bench about the size of a desk that you sat before on a stool. And coming down into that direct center of that desk, there was a wheel that rotated a pipe that went on up through the peak of the roof of this little shack that you have. Not too far above the roof, there was a boom extending, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 12 or 15 feet, horizontal boom, extended 12 to 15 feet either side, with the dipoles, vertical dipoles on the ends of this boom. twin feed lines from those dipoles come in, were phased out and dropped down through the pipe and into a Hammerland SX-28 receiver that we used there, which was battery operated. We had no power out there because to put any lines, any wires out there whatsoever, we felt would distort our bearings.
But it was a direction finder.
It was a direction finder. That's what it was. Adcock direction finder, right. They're medium frequencies.
In 1996, the then chairman of the FCC, Reed Hunt, announced a total restructuring and downsizing of the FCC. And in that, and this was the specific text, he basically stated that technology had come to the point to where they didn't need to have 9 individually manned monitoring stations anymore, that they could all be done remotely, and that they were going to center their operations from Laurel, Maryland. So, the FCC monitoring station was closed, or so we thought. They didn't actually close the station. The equipment is still there and running. It's just under remote control from Maryland. Now, what's interesting is it was like dental surgery for me to get that information out of the FCC. My question was very broad. The station's there. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. What are you doing with it now? It's still got the no trespassing signs, or the government will, you know, take away your birthday. What's going on? And they would give me the complete runaround when talking to the FCC. So I contacted my U.S. senator, who did an inquiry, who basically came back with this short paragraph that says it's part of the FCC's high-frequency detection finding network. And the network provides monitoring and interference resolution support for the federal government and public safety community and other FCC licensees. The network is vital to the FCC management of the HF spectrum below 30 megahertz within the U.S. and the enforcement of FCC spectrum rules. The network operation also provides special monitoring and technical assistance support during and after major emergencies. So basically the mission is the same. They're just doing it by remote control.
I have to maybe cry BS there, Randy.
It could be.
There's no antennas left that I know about.
Really?
That could support that. And McKinney did tell me that the NARCs took it over.
Oh.
Our Narcotics Enforcement Agency.
As what, office space?
That your senator wouldn't have been told that.
Yeah, as office space senators? Or what? Interesting.
But, you know, there's no antennas left, so how could it be doing huff-duff?
Yeah. In the early 1980s, and I didn't actually include this verbatim within the presentation, but I'll basically tell you what went on. When I took my tour, they said, Randy, if you really want to see what's going on, you got to come out here at night sometime. So, you know, when you're getting off work or something, give a call and see if someone's available that you can come and sit in while we're working. So a couple weeks later, I called when I was about to get off at 11 o'clock at night. The engineer on duty, and I can't remember the guy's name at all, said, yeah, we've been expecting that you'd be contacting us, and tonight's a great night. We've got a complaint that we're following up on. Come on out. The complaint they had was from amateur radio operators that some guy was getting on the air late at night, drunker than hell, and basically preaching, you know, just going off and, you know, profane and everything else, like you put a brick on the mic key. And the monitoring stations they had was Grand Island, one that was in the southeast somewhere.
Atlanta?
I think Alabama.
Powder Springs.
Maybe Powder Springs. I think they also had Alaska looking in on it, too, because the guy was bored up there. But whenever this guy would come on the air, and he was definitely hammered and mouthy, and he would have one hand on the teletype, the other hand on the oscilloscope, and when the guy would transmit, he'd type on, and when he stopped transmitting, he'd just say off once. And less than 5 minutes, they triangulated a fix on him. It turns out he was on a boat off the coast of Wilmington, Delaware, about 10 miles. The way they dealt with the situation was they contacted the Coast Guard to go after him and arrest him for drunk boating. Because that got them off the air, you know, so.
PWI.
Yeah, yeah. So that ended that guy's short radio career. But it was very interesting to sit back and watch them actually doing this. And
during World War II, did you have any military police guard in the place?
It's possible because the just west of there, like I said, is the ammunition plant, which has a huge guard force. Even when I was living there in the 80s, there was also an Air Force monitoring station that was decommissioned in about the winter of 1982, and somebody let loose a rail car off the Burlington Northern siding, and it crashed the gate on the north side of that ammunition plant. The car just rolled through the gate, you know, and smashed it. And we dispatched sheriff's deputies, but it was interesting that there was a lot of military personnel in full camouflage with M16s walking around, too. So if that was the case for someone doing vandalism to the gate at a decommissioned ammunition plant, I'm sure that during World War II they had this pretty well protected. Basically, my experience with the FCC is, unless it's bothering, say, like public safety, which is, you know, an emergency, but if it's something like this, if it's seriously affecting revenue, they'll go after it. I've found that in ham radio, if we provide them all the evidence up front, then they'll go out and follow up on it. So they got too many people. I'm definitely not going to read this. This was the paragraph at the back of the article, you know, where they say, about the author. And it just basically says that, you know, I grew up in Kearney, Nebraska. I worked 911 communications. I was a police officer for 16 years. I'm now working for IBM. Ta-da!
Great. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.